Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Transportation Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, March 19th. We are in the Barnes Committee Room, Room 124 of the Alaska State Capitol. Let the record reflect that the time is 1:01 p.m. For the House today, we have present Representative Vance, Representative Stutes, Representative Mina, and myself, Chair McCabe. The staff assisting us today are Linda Jensen with House Records and Susan Quigley with the LIO. Angela Steppel is my committee aide. Thank you for your service, everyone. Please silence your cell phones. Today we have two items on the agenda. The committee will be hearing public testimony for HB 386 with a short title of Obstruction of Public Places Trespassing. I'm hoping we can get through public testimony by 1:30 when we will start our joint meeting with the Senate. Due to time constraints today, I'm going to have to set a time limit of 1 minute. Hopefully that will get us through all callers. If you don't want to sit online, you can email us at house.transportation@akleg.gov. I will go ahead now and open public testimony, and I ask that those wishing to testify limit their testimony to 1 minute. So I'm opening public testimony, and online now, the first person we'll go to is Michael Patterson. If you would put your name on record, sir, and state your affiliation and begin your testimony.
Hello?
We hear you. Hello, Michael. Can you hear me? Michael Patterson, you're online. Go ahead and put your name on record and give us your testimony, please.
No, I can't.
Okay, we'll come back to you. And for the record, Representative Sumner has joined us at 1:02. Next, we'll go to Michael Garvey, Advocacy Director of the ACLU. Michael, can you hear me? Michael Garvey.
Hello, I'm speaking to the committee.
Yes, you are. Michael, go ahead and put your name on the record and give us your testimony, please. Okay, we'll take a brief at ease.
That this bill, there are new crime, enhanced penalties, and extreme civil penalties, would seek to punish Alaskans through the courts and their pocketbooks for exercising these rights. Beyond this, when the state regulates speech and expression, it must do so in a narrowly tailored way that satisfies the compelling government interest. The bill is too broad and unjustified in its rationale to clear that bar. Lastly, to uphold Alaskans' due process rights, the state must clearly define conduct that is prohibited. This bill is too vague for Alaskans to know what conduct is out of bounds, and it relies on officers and prosecutors making judgment calls, which opens the door to uneven enforcement. Our government should look for ways to strengthen Alaskans' ability to exercise their rights in practice, not to scare people into silence. Thank you. For these reasons, we urge the committee not to advance it.
Thank you, Mr. Garvey. Should we try Michael Patterson again with the Party for Socialism and Liberation in Anchorage? Michael Patterson, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. We've managed to fix our microphones or whatever it was, so go ahead and put your name on record and give us your testimony.
All right. Thank you. Hi, my name is Michael Patterson, and I'm an organizer with the Party for Socialism and Liberation in Anchorage, and I'm calling today because PSL Anchorage stands in opposition to House Bill 386. As an organization that regularly engages in First Amendment-protected speech and activities, this bill is particularly troublesome because, as Mr. Garvey stated, that it is vague and essentially tries to tell Alaskans, working-class Alaskans, that they can't organize, they can't protest, and they can't exercise their First Amendment right to free speech. their right to assemble and their right to petition and address grievances with their government. This bill is frankly a waste of time. And also, I will say on a personal note, I am Muslim, and for the past 5 months, Muslims, Palestinians have been organizing around the ethnic cleansing in Gaza, and it's not really a surprise to me that this bill suddenly comes up in conjunction with the governor's anti-BDS administrative order. Furthermore, I'm an Iraq war veteran. No legislature, no governor is going to tell me that I can't use my First Amendment right. That's not happening. I have done more for the U.S. Constitution than most Americans have, and I will be damned if Governor Dunleavy is going to sit here and tell me that I can't use my First Amendment right. So just to reiterate, PSL Anchorage is in stark opposition to this bill. It is a waste of time. Please stop wasting our time with these bills that the people do not want, that are not popular, that are undemocratic. Stop assisting the governor in padding his resume before he leaves the governor's mansion.
Mr. Patterson,
thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Carolyn Saavedra. Please, can you hear us, Carolina? Ms. Saavedra, can you hear us? Okay, let's go to the next one. Jesse Saiki, S-A-I-K-I. Sorry if I butchered your name. You can put your name on record and give us your testimony, please.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. My name is Jesse Saiki, and I'm calling from East Anchorage in opposition of HB 386, an oppressive bill which attempts to scare empowered Alaskans into silence. It's more than evident that this bill is retaliatory to local organizers and organizations who are trying to do work that should be people should be involved in and supporting. This bill clearly violates our First Amendment rights and would be a huge violation and overstep by Governor Dunleavy and those who support this bill. Please stop this bill from advancing to protect our freedom of speech and constitutional rights. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Let's try Carolina Saavedra. Saavedra, can you put your name on record? Can you hear me? Still nothing. Okay, we'll go to Josh.
Hello.
Oh, there we go. Is this Carolina?
Yes, it's Carolina. How are you? Carolina. Thank you so much, and I apologize.
No problem. Go ahead.
My name is Carolina Saavedra. I'm calling from Eagle River, Anchorage, Alaska. I am calling to oppose HB 386. This bill is designed to have a chilling effect on freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. As the spontaneous bill stated, this bill was drafted in reaction to demonstrations and protests that have occurred recently in other parts of the country. The proponents of HB 396 claim the bill is content neutral, but it is notable that out of the three examples the Attorney General gave in his presentation last week, two were pro-Palestinian human rights protests. The bill is a sweeping modification of state law, touching upon multiple titles of our Alaska statutes, including Title II, Aeronautics, Title IX, Civil Procedure, Title XI, Criminal Law, and Title 38, Public Lands. The goal of this bill is to significantly increase penalties for conduct that is already outlawed while broadening the types of conduct that fall within this category. It also seeks to criminalize multiple other types of peaceful individual and collective expression, given unfettered discretion to the police apparatus to decide when and to whom to apply these disciplinary penalties. Sorry. The bill also invents a right for any person who felt inconvenience at all to sue anyone for damages if they believe they have caused their inconvenience. This overbroad bill would expose Alaskans to face felony charges and private lawsuits, no matter how brief or innocuous their conduct may have been. While the Attorney General claims that this bill seeks to strike a balance between the freedom of movement and freedom of speech and assembly, the bill only seeks to criminalize and chill First Amendment conduct.
So, Ms.
Indeed, it does nothing to ensure that freedom of speech can... Go ahead.
You've reached your time limit. Could you wrap it up?
Yes, yes. It doesn't do anything to ensure that freedom of speech can be protected on public lands, but it does not provide any protection from a reasonable arrest or civil persecution for demonstrations that are visible from high traffic places, even when there is no intent to block the bill. It is an authoritarian bill and will have the effect of chilling the fundamental First Amendment rights of Alaskans. And in fact, it is intended to do just that. So I encourage you to vote no.
Thank you very much. Now we will go to, first let me say that we've been joined by Representative Johnson and Representative McKay at 110. Now we'll go to Josh Smith in Anchorage. Josh, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
Hi.
Put your name on record and give us your testimony, please. You have 1 minute.
Absolutely. My name is Josh Smith out of Anchorage, and I'm calling in behalf of myself. I'm here to oppose House Bill 386. I'm an Air Force veteran. I grew up in a family of veterans. My dad retired Army, and something that was always paramount in my household was the respect for the Constitution, including the First Amendment. As my dad would put it, the First Amendment can be messy, but it wasn't written just for people to talk about the weather. It's for people to demand justice, accountability, express needs, and demand solutions of their government. So when it comes to House Bill 386, it's deeply problematic. Criminalizing the obstruction of free movement in public space is incredibly vague, and the enforcement will be varied, and will sequester a broad range of legal assembly and speech, which just tramples on the First Amendment rights of Alaskans. The reality is Alaskans aren't blocking highways. This is a solution looking for a problem. So what I would suggest is leave the right to peacefully assemble and speak in public spaces alone. Alaskans are not interested in this. Please leave the First Amendment alone. Sincerely, an Alaskan and a veteran. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Next, we have Phil Moser in Juneau. Phil, can you hear me?
Yes.
Please put your name on record and give your testimony. You have 1 minute.
My name is Philip Moser from Juneau, Alaska. I'm calling in opposition to HB 386. Protests and First Amendment rights aren't always easy, nor are they always compatible with easy answers or with comfort for the government. In fact, protests are there specifically because we are not hearing our representatives. We are not being represented properly. For Dunleavy's introduced bill, what sort of protest is acceptable to the governor? Through this bill, not even Martin Luther King Jr.'s march from Selma to Montgomery would have been acceptable. And Dunleavy, don't forget, introduced this bill back in February, Black History Month. What was known as Bloody Sunday, when state happened, when civil rights marchers tried to march while they were still waiting for a permit. This was the start of at least 5 days of marching. But while they were waiting for that permit to happen, Bloody Sunday, where state troopers brutally beat marchers and sprayed them with tear gas, went down in history. Dunleavy proposes that something like that, that a person like Martin Luther King should be subject to even more penalties and should have been subject to his detractors, to white supremacists, to the KKK, able to open up personal lawsuits against him.
Philip, if you could wrap it up, please.
The sit-ins, too, by the civil rights, organized by King and other civil rights organizers, would have been punished by this bill. In the end, I don't support this bill. I do not support its passing. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And once again, for those that didn't get a chance to give all their testimony, you can email it to house.transportation@akleg.gov, and we will ensure that it's listed in the bill packet. Next, we have Monica Whitman from Eagle River. Monica, can you hear me? Okay.
Hello, this is Monica Whitman. Can you hear me?
Yep, I hear you now. Go ahead and give us your name.
Perfect.
Put yourself on the record and begin your testimony. You have 1 minute.
Absolutely. My name is Monica Whitman. I'm calling on behalf of myself from Eagle River, Alaska. And I see this bill, which I adamantly oppose, as a thinly veiled attempt to intimidate people. I believe you're trying to prevent, or the governor's trying to prevent them from showing up at some of these protests, which is our First Amendment rights. And I've been to several protests in Anchorage. There's never been a need for riot police or any sort of protections of that sort. For the most part, they've been very well-attended and benign. To make it a felony and to have all of these restrictions on protesting when we already have laws in place, it just feels like a complete overreach and an intimidation act. And so I encourage you to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Monica. Next, we have Sydney Couchupin from Anchorage. Cynthia Couchupin, can you put yourself on record and give your testimony.
Yeah, hi, this is Cynthia Gachi-Payne. I'm from the Party for Socialism and Liberation Anchorage. I oppose this bill mainly because I feel that this isn't a necessary bill. One, it goes against the Constitution and our right of freedom of speech. That's first and foremost. Second, as someone who has been organizing in the city of Anchorage for the last 4 years, has organized many protests. There has never been any issues with, people basically, I guess, standing in the street and refusing to move. There's never been any rioting or any sort of destruction of any kind. I think that it is really kind of a false narrative to imply that these protests are causing any sort of real disruption. When people do march in the street, it is maybe at the most a few minutes that they are actually in possibly anybody's way. People purposely take routes that are not as much traffic as, main roads for that reason of, safety being one of the main concerns. So really this bill is just unnecessary and just shows, that the governor does not care about our constitution, and our First Amendment right to freedom of speech. So
thank you, Cynthia. Next we have Menika Thiru from Anchorage.
Hi, my name is Menika Thiru and I live in East Anchorage. I'm calling on behalf of myself. And I was calling to express my opposition to HB 386. Like many of the other callers, I believe that this is an attempt to infringe on my First Amendment right to free speech, and that it violates my right to assemble. I believe that these are fundamental rights that should be protected. I've always thought of protests as an integral part of American life. I have personally participated in many protests and will continue to do so as an Alaskan. So I ask this committee to please stop this bill from advancing, as it would infringe on the rights of Alaskans to make their voices heard.
Thank you so much for your testimony. That's the last person we have online. In the room, I think I have Morgan Lim from Planned Parenthood Alliance for Advocates. If you'd place your name on the record, sir, and I have to limit you, even though you're in the room, to 1 minute, because that's what I did for everyone else. So
you gotcha.
My apologies.
Thank you, Chair McCabe and members of the House Transportation Committee. For the record, my name is Morgan Lim. I'm a Juneau resident, and today I'm testifying on behalf of Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates. PPAA strongly opposes HB 386, a bill that would criminalize Alaskans who exercise their freedom of speech and assembly. The language of this bill is both so broad that it renders constitutionally protected speech illegal and so vague that those who wish to follow or enforce the law are unclear as to the legislation's scope. Vague and overly broad laws can be applied selectively by law enforcement against parties engaged in disfavored speech. There is no way for the state to neutrally apply this bill, which could be used to target politically disfavored speech, and it raises more questions than answers about what conduct would be permissible. The new obstruction of free passage crime appears to criminalize homelessness in public spaces and could be weaponized by law enforcement to targetize marginalized groups, including the unhoused, exacerbating rather than alleviating Alaska's housing crisis. This legislation does not make Alaskans safer or address a current problem for people protesting across the state. Instead, it is a government overreach that sends a threatening message to protesters in order to chill free speech. Please oppose HB 386. Thank you.
Well, right at 1 minute. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Is there anyone else in the room wishing to testify? Susan, anyone else online? Okay, with that, I'm going to close public testimony. I'm going to take an ease for a minute and allow the Senate to come in and bring in the robo-dog, and we will begin the joint meeting at 1:30. I know that two of you have other things, but come on back and you can play with the dog.
Cool.
At ease. Okay, I'd like to call the Joint Senate House Transportation Committee meeting to order. The House Committee has already done roll call. Senator Kaufman, would you like to call the roll for the Senate Transportation Committee?
Thank you. For the Senate today, we have present Vice Chair David Wilson. We have Senator Rob Keel, and Rob Keel. I'm sorry. It's something about the proximity there. So Senator Robert Myers, I apologize, Rob. I do not see Lukey Tobin here, so I guess we'll proceed with that. We also have Emma Torkelson, Senate Committee Aide, assisting us today.
Thank you. To kick off today's presentation, we'll start by hearing from Ryan Marlowe, the UAS Program Coordinator in Statewide Aviation, who will introduce us to the fascinating world of unmanned aircraft systems. Assisting Ryan is Troy LaRue, the Division Operations Manager at Statewide Aviation. They will join us at the table in showcasing our innovative RoboDog. Our slide presentation is titled Our Innovations in Autonomous and Uncrewed Systems, highlighting the groundbreaking work DOT is doing in this field. So, gentlemen.
Just for the record, just to note that Senator Jesse Keel just arrived at 1:29 p.m.
Thank you. So, gentlemen, put your names on the record and off we go.
Yep. Troy LaRue, Division Operations Manager, Statewide Aviation.
And Ryan Marlowe, UAS Program Manager, Statewide Aviation. Today we're here to talk about innovations in autonomous and uncrewed vehicles. To my side, we're also joined by Aurora, one of those autonomous vehicles, but really wanting to highlight what DOT has been working on the last couple years with vehicles, uncrewed systems, drones. Let's see. How we're utilizing this technology. DOT, back in 2017, started utilizing drones for remote sensing in our survey and construction groups up in northern region. That has fast evolved into bridge inspections, hydrology, avalanche detection, statewide inspection of airports. Most importantly, the ability for us to respond to the growing demand for more information with natural disasters. So, what we're highlighting here and on the video is drone footage of all of the response from the earthquake there in Anchorage, just highlighting what can happen, what we can utilize this documentation for, and really how we take that data and migrate it into a usable form. Video is very powerful, but so is repeatable data. So is data that allows for us to look for change detection that we've started to utilize moving forward. So, over the couple of pullaways that we have here, we wanted to highlight a lot of the technology that's being deployed. Up on Dalton Highway, we had a close washout on milepost 403.5. Now, this was an amazing opportunity for us to test some technology that we were deploying with the avalanche program, actually down here on Thane Road. One of our drone docks, with the ability for us to control it remotely, we were able to take it up to Dalton Highway, drop it off, connect it with low Earth orbit communications, and fly it from almost 2,000 miles away. Now, that type of ability for us to live stream, I know when we were live streaming on Microsoft Teams, there were some people who were like, how are we getting live footage of this event while we're talking on this Teams call? And the ability to share imagery daily, and in some cases twice a day, all the way to SCOC. That ability for remote sensing technology is really changing the way that we view how we respond to natural disasters. So it's full transparency, the ability for us to process data in the cloud, and immediately, in some cases that same day, share that imagery with teams across the globe. So our partnership with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Akwasi team has allowed for us with the UAS test site to go after some of these experimental waivers. So one of the big items is beyond visual line of sight with FAA or BVLOS. That one has been a tough cookie to crack. And so with the state being able to utilize our public status for public aircraft, we're able to utilize these platforms in ways that industry can't quite get to. So we're given a little bit more leniency on responding to these setting up TFR, setting up the data collection, but really paving the way so that industry can learn from these items and start to deploy these moving forward.
Okay, can we stop there for a second? Because you said a few things that people probably don't understand. So yes. TFR.
Temporary flight restriction.
So that's what you set up when you have to run a drone somewhere. You set it up with the FAA. They broadcast it to all the private pilots so that no private pilot in his super cub looking for moose bumbles into that area and runs into our big expensive drone, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Cool. And you brought up a great point. A lot of this technology, why we're having such a barrier to entry with beyond visual line of sight, is we are now facing, you know, the super cub flying at 50 feet. How do we communicate with them? You know, how do we deploy this technology? And so we're leveraging a lot of those items with the FAA is authority of that airspace. So a TFR gives DOT the ability to launch and recover assets remotely.
So that kind of brings up another question. So you said that your public use aircraft, so line of sight rules that normally affect the rest of the drone pilot world don't necessarily apply to the state. Is that what I heard you say?
The reason why is because we've applied for Beyond Visual Line of Sight COAs. Okay. So both for tactical use, emergency use. COA. Thank you. certificate of authorization, basically FAA approval. So we still have to go through the same safety justification in cases. But without being able to utilize that public agency status as well as the partnership with the test site up here, we would not be able to accomplish these missions.
So for those that don't know, the FAA has restricted drones. You have to be in the line of sight. So that's what has prevented Amazon, UPS, those that are interested in drone delivery from actually implementing that program, because they haven't figured out a way yet to deliver a package to you without an operator right there within line of sight of the drone. So it's a restriction that we all have. The question I have is, as the FAA requires all civilian Super Cubs to have the, and I forget what the name of it is, but the
remote ID
transponder, and I assume our drones have those, so they're talking to each other and they can actually provide their own separation. Is there any discussion with the FAA about finally getting rid of the line of sight requirement?
At the moment, remote ID just came out here. Actually, it became mandatory for all unmanned systems as of Monday. And so every platform that is purchased in the U.S., manufacturers, the system must be compliant by broadcasting a digital license plate. For aviation, we have ADS-B,
right,
which is only required for civil operators, 135, and areas that require that surveillance. So a mixture of both hasn't been done yet, which, as we're looking at surveillance and different technologies, that's where a lot of these newer age technologies that can make a hybrid system to showcase we do have UAS in the area, we do have manned operations, and how to build those separation rules with surveillance.
And that's the real hang up with the FAA, right, is there's going to be a drone airplane collision. So by being in line of sight with your drone, you can see the Super Cub coming and you can dive or, you know, reduce altitude, whatever. So, all right. Sorry. On we go.
But you bring up, another good item. When we set this up, we, of course, locked the airspace out, but we found one major item that we didn't have, basic VHF communications, the ability to communicate with those Super Cubs or to broadcast when we were going live. We relied heavily on the flight service station to broadcast on the flight service station frequencies for pilots coming in and out. And we set up notice to air missions. So we tried our best to alert the local workforce, but we found that was one item that we took away from this, is we need better communications.
So, yeah, that's a really good point. When you're parachuting out of an airplane, you know, you're obviously dumping the parachutists out with no radios or no transponders or anything, and the pilots are always transmitting. You know, here I am at 11,000 feet dropping paratroopers and parachutists in 30 seconds over this airport, and it warns the rest of the pilots. So maybe that's if you had a radio on there and you were talking to pilots and you could, every so often could warn them that it was, that you had a drone in the area. It's probably a good idea.
Absolutely. And automated voice. I mean, just being the ability for us to highlight, that there's a system in the area and move forward with it. On screen, you can also see the ability with video documentation. These are items that we shared on social media as we're looking for transparency, but really bringing a lot of this technology to the modern age with the social media aspect. So, you know, you'll hear me talk a lot today about transparency. These drones are letting us showcase what's happening from the air, documenting, you know, what volume is moving there or what's changing. Alaska's going through a rapid, you know, change across our environment, and we're trying to use all of these tools in these remote locations to the best of our ability. So it's incredibly exciting to showcase that this one technology is having so many impacts on so many different markets.
Cool.
Of course, a lot of you are aware of the, you know, the Mendenhall Glacier outburst. This one, of course, we were fortunately, we were testing an experimental LIDAR system in town, which LIDAR stands for light detection and ranging. It's basically a laser that spins really fast and allows for us to collect high resolution detail. So to put that in the context, if we were to fly some of our older systems in this area, it would take us 2 days to capture this environment. With this new LIDAR system, we were able to capture all the way to the glacier, to the bridge in about 40 minutes. So the ability for us to rapid respond, collect data, what we're looking for is change detection. What was here before, what isn't here now, and how do we quantify, you know, where the high water levels are. Another interesting issue with this is the ability to collect imagery. So we collected over 6,000 photos and started processing that in our cloud service. We found out really fast that the state's network couldn't handle a single 250-gig file. So we had to put it out onto a secondary network and move it up. So as we're creating these larger projects, I mean, the best way to say it is we're creating high-resolution video games of the entire valley. And then we're trying to run that through our state network. So the network was never built for that. So we're having a lot of lessons as we're storing this data. We're governing, we're building, you know, what we do keep, but the products and the deliverables with that imagery and LIDAR data is really what we're looking at. On the right here, you can see we're using the same Alta X platform, which is our heavy lift. It's a company made here in America with Alta, and then our VTOL platform here, it's Quantum's Trinity Pro that allows for us to basically take off and then it boots into an airplane. So in places where we don't have accessible runways, or really any place to take off from, you just need a small little gap in the trees, and now we can deploy these advanced sensors over the course of 4 to 5 miles. Lastly, the Wrangell landslide. With lessons learned from Dead Horse, with the washout, numerous responses, Wrangell was an interesting one for the department, not only because we were on scene as initial first responders with a lot of the systems flying thermal, assisting the search and rescue teams. This was really the first time that we got to try out how weatherproof our systems were as it was pouring down rain. And so in the first 5 days, we had over 80 hours of flight time with these UAS platforms. So a very impressive item where a lot of the crews would not even go out unless those drones were up there monitoring the slope stability. So you can see the dock again, the ability for us to set up these remote sites, but and you can see the temporary flight restriction, but all of these things as we're learning, the ability for us to capture and duplicate data over and over again. This is on the screen down here, a 90-day change detection from the slide path from the 22nd all the way to the 20th, so in 90 days. In that time period, we were able to collect 65 remote scans. So this is meaning that our operators are flying from our remote ops center in Juneau and able to process that data over and over again and look for it. So we can see major change down where we had construction. Of course, some run out with the water, but overall, not much movement on that slope. So this is an incredible use of this technology where we're looking for, you know, how stable is the slope? How can we set this up in other places that we're unsure of? As we're moving, we're also looking at installing these at airports where we're dealing with permafrost. And so as we start to have these remote abilities, the ability to remove the risk to the the data collection or actually having folks up on the slide area is really an impressive item. One of my favorite items is while we were there, we got to meet with the T3, so the STEM outreach groups, but the local community of Wrangell. We had a lot of drone operators that were actually, I believe they were heading to Juneau the next week to get their Part 107. But being able to showcase this technology and kind of the next operators that will be operating these systems remotely and just seeing where their program is going on how to document, how to get ready for change detection. I heard a story today that one of those students actually got an email from Google because he had filmed the entire town of Wrangell for Google Street Maps. And they had accessed that because he had one of the only shots of the landslide pre-landslide. And so that image got viewed over a million times because they were looking for pre-post analysis with it. So you can see that drones are amazing in many ways, but data and the way that we collect that is really the most important item. So research and development initiatives. We are constantly working through our many groups. I mentioned Avalanche. This has been an impressive opportunity for us to starting with the bigger items, so Avalanche shoots. You know, a lot of folks don't think of Avalanche as assets, but the ability for us to document something larger than life and being able to repeat that, looking for snow depth analysis, looking for the ability to see, you know, hey, did our howitzer mitigation, was it successful? Do we need to change what we're doing with it? So our remote data workflows and the GIS and the automation is something that we've really worked considerably on. We were pretty fast to roll out our drone program and found out really fast that we are starting to redline a lot of our storage systems, our drives, our videos. You know, 4K video times 100 drones and pilots across just DOT, our IT folks were not very happy with us. So working with our enterprise clients with Esri, we were able to start processing items in the cloud and pulling off a lot of that congestion and speed by being able to process these items remotely. So pretty impressive. Our docs can sit out here. Once they collect, think of it as like an office printer. You send a mission to it. It's able to go fly it. It lands, uploads it, automatically processes it, and makes it available for multiple services. So all the way to our cloud bucket or dashboards. So that's really one of our big push is getting this imagery available for everyone as fast as possible. Question.
Yep. Go ahead, Senator Wilson.
Thank you, through the chair. What's the sort of band or frequency of communication with the drones?
Through the chair. As far as our current communications, right now we use civilian band, so 2.4 and 5.8 gigahertz. And we are also getting ready to start testing the 900 and 600 range with cellular and LTE enabled systems. So we're still working with a lot of the air care or the cellular providers because when they built their cellular networks, they didn't expect something to be flying in an X, Y, and Z pattern. They expect it to be on the ground at all times. So there's a lot of interest in the utilization of cellular as the primary control link and then utilizing low Earth orbit as backhaul for communication.
Okay. Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay, on we go.
And one of the, you know, as I mentioned before, our Avalanche team, the ability for us to drop explosives. Alaska DOT is the first in the nation to not only be able to carry dangerous weapons, but in the video here, we're showcasing, we have successfully dropped two ordnance rounds. And here next week, we'll be trialing another payload as well. So this is an incredible opportunity as we start to spread out our tools available for avalanche mitigation into areas like down here in Juneau, where we're limited to heli bombing or avalancher or hand rounds. It gives us another option and opportunity to partner. So we're partnered with Alaska Railroad, Drone Amplified, and CIL Explosives on deployment of this platform. So very, very proud of it.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the drone dropped explosives, is that what you're leaning towards doing to replace the howitzers since you can't use those for much longer?
Through the chair, it's not a replacement for the howitzer. As always, these are other tools. Really what this is just the ability for us as we're starting to map and head towards RACs, or remotely operated avalanche control systems. All of these are, you know, have their flaws, but looking towards the future of, you know, sustainment, maintenance, the howitzer program is starting to get old, you know, finding other options. I remember when we first kind of pitched on the utilization of utilizing drones, it was a big no from everybody. And so the fact that we are here today actually testing it, it's not a howitzer replacement, but it's our pathway towards kind of the systematic view of the entire avalanche system with these remotely operated control systems.
Anybody else? On we go.
So you can kind of start to see the theme, how we can collect these environments in real time, which is why we've partnered with Department of Public Safety and Anchorage Police Department to trial unmanned systems for traffic and fatal collision reconstruction. This allows for us to speed up the amount of time that traffic is closed. Believe it or not, when we are waiting for traffic to be cleared, a lot of times we're waiting on their traditional scanners to finish scanning. So from the deployment on where we've utilized drones on scene, we've dropped their on scene time to about 30 minutes instead of a couple hours with the previous technology. Huh. So same workflow, same simulation. You can see even with the overhead, we can actually simulate those impacts, trajectories, and visualize everything. Once again, just like a video game. So this technology does not just apply to DOT. These workflows can be shared with multiple agencies and industry. It's just standardizing the collection and making sure that everybody has access to these platforms. Bridge inspections. Once again, just the ability for us to document. Now, what makes this Koyukuk River so impressive? This is the first time we'd ever streamed over Starlink. For those of you that are wondering where's Koyukuk River, it's about 30 minutes north of Wiseman, and gives us a sense that there is no cell service for the next couple of hours. So the ability for us to broadcast these live streams and 3D scans, I think on this call we had about 20 people. That's from Federal Highways, Bridge Team, our consultant, but being able to bring everybody out to one spot and then 3D scan it to be able to decide, hey, we need to cut here, here, and here, the ability to go back and look at it. This is really where change detection, 3D scanning, and live streaming are all coming together on these multiple items. So we've been evaluating two types, the mobile panels that we've been starting to install on our vehicle and some of the backpack options for folks that have to get into small planes. A lot of our technology we purposely keep small because we know a lot of times we're having to get in the back of a 172. So we call it our 172 rule, is that if we can't get it small enough to get in a small plane, then it's probably not something that we plan on investing in. So across the board, the ability for us to respond to these items with sometimes just one person. Now, we'll showcase here a little bit later. This system allowed for the operator to override commands. So if there's something where, say, somebody gets out into the field and doesn't have the experience to fly into the bridge, with the bandwidth and the connection, we can actually override controls. And somebody, once again, from Juno can inspect that bridge and say, hey, perfect, thank you, I have everything I need, and hand off controls. And we have all of the data moving forward. So you can see it just continues to roll into more and more partnerships. With a lot of our older thermal systems, we have started working with search and rescue groups. So JMR, AMRG, MATSAR. This is a video from MATSAR where they did, they found it with the drone faster than the canine units found the heat signature. So really starting to utilize this for avalanche safety, avalanche recovery. But we've developed the process in partnership with DPS on, in the event that these happens, the ability to utilize state assets for search and rescue with DPS under their training authority, setting up our temporary flight restrictions, and really allowing for that beyond visual line of sight to happen if human life is in danger. So we are working with getting these systems deployed into the hands of first responders, search and rescue, and really those first folks on scene.
One more question from Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, what's the price tag for these for search and rescue?
A couple of the different systems. The one pictured here, we're looking right around $20,000. Some of the other thermal systems that are available can be upwards or as low as $5,000. So, and that's kind of what we're looking at as systems are aging out of DOT, making them available for the search and rescue agencies that wouldn't otherwise be able to afford these platforms. So,
thank you.
So that's a question that I have. So we had DPS was in here earlier this year talking about drones and how useful they can be to the troopers. But in a situation like this, do they call you guys up and you operate the drone, or are the troopers trained? Are you doing the training? So who? It seems like a number of agencies in the state government have or are interested in drones. So who's the sort of controlling agency?
We try not to be the controlling agency. We partner, we help write waivers, but basically the agencies are up for their own staff. As far as equipment goes, if we do have equipment available, that's one of the more amazing items is right now DNR, DPS, and DOT all have the same manual for remote ops, which allows for us to easily facilitate training, have aircraft available, and move things back and forth. So as we start to bring online other, and I believe DEC as well, but as we start to bring on other state agencies, all of the documents are already available so that we can share these resources on the back end.
Thanks. Who's doing the training?
Depending on what we're doing, sometimes we bring up the manufacturers, DOT host training. Everybody pretty much hosts their training individually. We just had a training last week with Anchorage Police Department and industry and DPS with some of the newer systems as well.
Nice. Okay.
So our team is also focusing on modernizing a lot of our statewide equipment fleet vehicles. So as we're looking at, hey, these drones in the field are amazing, but communications, data, you know, how do we bring this technology out into the field with us? And so the picture on the bottom is down in Valdez here about 2 weeks ago. It's pitch black and raining, and we are doing avalanche mitigation. The drone is up inside of our temporary flight restriction at about 2,000 feet, and we're watching avalanche come down in pitch black by utilizing that thermal camera. So before, it would require crews to shoot, you know, 16 exploratory rounds and then go see if anything hit the road. Now we're able to see where slide paths are coming down. We're actually able to go investigate. So this technology is really allowing for us to hone in our usage, our availability, and, you know, kind of the danger of avalanche mitigation. So on the other side of the house, electric vehicles. This has been something that we've been starting to test. It's amazing what 240 volts at 60 amps can give you while you're out in the middle of nowhere. The ability to power these remote docks for, you know, up to 10 days, radio stations, repeaters, rebroadcasters. So as we have these vehicles and we're responding to these items, I know Highland Road in Anchorage is notoriously offline. There's no connection. This vehicle that's in the picture here with Starlink was able to go up there and live broadcast a drone flight while communicating on Teams and share that information in real time. So by us starting to handle our back-end network, we're able to start utilizing a lot of these technologies and communication. And working with the statewide radio shop and ALMR, you can kind of see my crazy drawings up here of what these vehicles allow for us to do. But we can drop these off anywhere on the road system, call into them, rebroadcast, launch drones, really kind of setting these systems up for any agency to have access to this type of technology when the need arises. So before I get off innovations, wanted to talk about a really amazing project that we're working on. Alaska DOT was the recipient of a SMART grant award from US DOT. This was for $1.9 million, with basically the primary goal of using drone technology to conduct critical infrastructure inspections for rural Alaska, looking at snow, ice roads, you know, seasonal trails with rural Alaska. So I do have a video here. highlighting with ABCP, so we'll see if the audio plays so you can kind of see what we're working on with their team.
My name is Clarence Daniel. I'm the Community Development Division Director at ABCP. The Yukon Kuskokwim Delta area is about the size of the state of Oregon. Our area is an isolated area. There are no roads in or out, so we rely on air transportation or river transportation. There are two major rivers in our region. They are pretty much the lifeline. So then in the winter, we have the Kuskokwim Ice Road that is a low-cost alternative to the high cost of air travel. One of the primary things I'd like to see is being able to develop a uniform safety data reporting system. We could use this data to establish apps for people. So if there was an ice road that was shut down, then it could show on the map like the 511 does for the state highways. You know, if there's an open hole or if one of the rivers that the winter trails cross isn't frozen yet, that things like that can be flagged as hazards so that people know before they go that they would have to avoid those areas or go around those areas in order to be safe. When it comes to disaster response in our area, we could get our staff out to the village. They can go and fly the drone over damaged infrastructure. They can fly it over possible homes that were damaged from the storms. The drone can immediately get out and live stream to us here or even in Anchorage or even with DOT or even with FEMA. That can really speed up the process of getting help to people that need it. I'm so happy to see that soon becoming a reality through the partnership with DOT. Sky's the limit. We could all go all the way to the sun and back with what we can do.
So you can see the data collection, and as we start to move this technology out into rural Alaska, that partnership that we have with these communities is allowing for us to prioritize that infrastructure inspection while also showcasing how this technology can change the way that lands can be managed, that safety can be achieved, and documentation of these seasonal assets that have been, I don't want to say an unobtainable goal, but a hard-to-reach goal with GIS mapping. So, lastly, our future directions and opportunities. You've seen a lot of the technology here that has been developed with our Avalanche program, but drone docks has been something that we have, in many cases, been leading the nation with. Ourselves, Caltrans, and North Carolina have all been early adopters with this technology and partnering with the FAA. The ability for us to launch and recover within those environments, or even if there is a incident where we detect that an avalanche has occurred, the ability for these systems to dispatch and take photos and videos or immediately start searching for thermal signatures. That response and ability with these systems as we start to deploy them is an incredible asset. Question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Good. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So those drone docks, if I'm understanding you correctly, that would be more or less automated. So how does that fit into the BIVLOS permission from the FAA?
Through the chair. At the moment, there are no automated flights. We are still manually controlling them, but I'm glad you asked. Remote ID is still something that we're figuring out. It still requires to know, you know, if we start a remote connection, it knows where the operator is flying from and allows for us to showcase that. So scheduled remote or truly autonomous operations is something that we're working towards. But for what you saw today with Dalton Highway and Wrangell, there's an operator on the backside of that every time that we fly, just for safety.
Okay.
Thanks.
And so on screen, you can see we've logged into the aircraft actually out here last summer on Thane Road. We're running through the initial powering on. But just like you would fly a regular drone, the ability to start things up, override the sensors, go for a flight. really giving you the ability to either send a mission, just like I mentioned with the printer, or going for a free flight. So if we're going to go check something out or go visualize something, we can return back to the same location. And that really gives us the ability to manage more with less. I'll jump here into the ability for us to close up this dock. But what is really amazing is as we're doing flight planning, we can load in LiDAR data, lights detection and ranging, and really be able to fly against known issues. So one of the critical items that we've struggled with in the past is we were crashing these drones into the hillside left and right because we had no terrain awareness. So the ability for us to load the terrain, this allows for these drones to fly in complete IFR conditions because we're able to path and fly directly off of terrain with this. So this increases our collection methodologies, but really showcases how these systems can be utilized close to terrain without CFIT incidents. Controlled flight into terrain. A couple last items. You can kind of see the themes here. Compact rapid deployables, emergency communications. Here is an electric truck with a drone dock in the back. So that, as I was mentioning with the 240 volt and the FirstNet CRDs. Now what these are mini cell sites that we can broadcast. And within about a half mile to a mile of where these are, we have full LTE communications. So once you remember my 172 rule is we can take those now on our plane anywhere, drop those, and within about 10 minutes, we have full self-service. With the dock, we now have back-end communication to go start doing mapping missions, live video. So all of that then ties back into broadband with the tie-in with our ALMR network or the Alaska Land Mobile Radio. We're just waiting on FedRAMP approval to be able to start utilizing this, but we'll be able to backhaul that broadcast across Starlink, across LTE. If there's internet connection, we will now have ALMR radio connections, which basically means any place that we take this low orbit communications, we can have full simplex and basic radio communications. So an amazing, as we're learning through a lot of these disaster responses, we are fixing a lot of the things on the way. So that way we have these assets and resources available to respond to these items into the future. And I'm sure you watched Bring Aurora in. Let me boot Aurora up since she takes a little second to. So Aurora, for those of you that have not seen it, is the first of its kind wildlife hazard reduction robot. Aurora is a Boston Dynamics spot dog that will be utilized up in Fairbanks, Alaska, for the sole purpose of clearing wildlife. This will give us the ability to test kind of routine every hour on the hour, being able to dispatch and clear out the infields off the display threshold to the fence line, but really start testing what it's like to have USDA biologists performing mitigation. Knowing that this is going to build out into the ability to do this at additional airports where we can log in remotely. Say from here out to Kluwak or Juneau to St. Paul, the ability to spread out the workforce through the use of robotics and remote sensing systems is really what we're excited to start testing. So Aurora will have an ADS-B system on board that will be broadcasting to other aircraft in the area or in the movement area, and also be broadcasting or being able to be controlled over LTE. So one of the key items that we're really excited with is being able to replace some of the panels and make it look like a coyote or make it look like a fox. The sole purpose of this is to act as a predator and allow for us to invoke that response in wildlife without having to use other mitigation means. So moving forward, this will be, as I mentioned before, kind of a first of its kind with FAA, with the community. But otherwise, in the off time, Aurora will be spending her time during the winters in classrooms and airport outreach for airport safety moving forward.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was able to travel out to St. George many years ago. Are we going to be able to hook up like air like those air cannons to it in terms of bird mitigation and send that out to the runway and send that back in and recycle like that type of runway?
Through the chair. At the moment, Aurora will be a standalone platform just to see how effective it is by itself. I'm sure future reiterations, but that will be on USDA's side. DOT is basically making sure the technology works within the airport environment and is safe. But we're leaving that up to USDA to make the call on what they're willing to allow on those permits.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. So for those that don't know, that birds and airplanes don't mix very well. You've all seen Sully, and I had a friend that had the contract down in the Kodiak airport. He was supposed to go out every time 15 minutes before the Alaska jet came in, and he had these blank shotgun rounds. They call them poppers. They fly out about 50 feet, and then they explode, and he would scare the seagulls away from the approach end of the runway. That was, I think he made $20,000 or $25,000 a year, something like that. This was 20 years ago doing that. And what Senator Wilson said is now we have a St. George airport where we're bringing in airplanes and nobody there to scare the birds away. And it's pretty dangerous for airplanes. In fact, they try everything they can, from cutting the grass real short to keep the bird's nest out in Anchorage on that little island in the middle of Lake Hood. They called it Hog Island because they used to put hogs out there to eat the seagull eggs off of the shore, the duck eggs, to keep the birds down. So we spend, the DOT does, and airlines do, spend a lot of money to mitigate birds one way or the other. So this is kind of exciting technology, and I think you're getting ready to show us.
Yeah, so luckily it's already booted up for us. So
hopefully KTOO can get their cameras on it so that the public can see it. So we'll just, for the committee, we'll just stay on the record and keep the cameras rolling so that the public can see this amazing technology.
Now, Aurora is broadcasting LIDAR around it. That's basically allowing for it to see what it can do as far as what it's going to run into. But as far as the platform itself, you can see I can control it from a tablet. I can control it from a computer. And into the future items, when we schedule it, you can control it from a scheduled automation. Now, we don't have the same rules that we do with drones, where an operator needs to be there, but we are treating it in the same manner of, we don't plan to let this thing operate autonomously until we have those security parameters in place on the airport. So it'll always have an operator for the time being.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it waterproof? Can you use it in the rain?
Yes. All of the newer technology that we've been through the chair, all of the newer technology that we've been deploying is weather sealed. So I believe, and I'll get back to you on, it's either an IP64 or IP65 rating for weather resistance.
And follow up. I don't know those ratings. Is it waterproof enough? Is it waterproof enough that, in Skagway, it's a riverbed right next to the runway. If it were to slip and tumble, could it splash back out, or is it done?
Through the chair, I have been playing with it in water and snow and testing those exact items. So far, I have had it in water and no issues. So we are still evaluating that and creating those environments. We are being cautious with it since we still need to get the initial research done. But those are all questions, Fairbanks does have the pond there, and we need to understand that if it can survive that, or if it does go into there, what's the survivability on it? So
you have to make it hop.
Yes.
That fascinates me that it can do it on two legs.
So one of the more fascinating items, we've all seen the Boston Dynamics videos of them getting kicked around or hit with the hockey stick, but the balance and the capability of these systems is quite impressive. So I'll put it into a, so you can see it can show off pretty well. It can move left, right, forward, backwards. And we can even go to a jog as well.
Can you itch like a regular dog?
Yeah, we don't bark. So no hair. But yeah, as far as the pushing items, you can see there too.
No Tootsie Rolls in the committee room either?
Yes. make a lot of noise for the folks downstairs, but Yeah, those are all items that, you know, we're going into this knowing that we're going to have challenges with how do we adapt the robotic platform to wildlife mitigation. But as you said earlier, I mean, we spend a lot of funding on it. And so with these platforms really testing out, you know, will this work in the wildlife hazard? Another major benefit for us is we can go inspect, you know, when we know we have outages with lighting, we can go look at items. So really becoming an asset for the department on numerous items, you know, search and rescue or natural disasters. That's really where robotics is allowing for us to put these systems in instead of sending in our folks.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you. Two questions. One, what's the general cost? And two, the Federal Highway Administration has a wildlife mitigation grant. Would that be qualified for use of future robotic services for our state?
As far as the federal highways, I will definitely look into that. We have not currently been utilizing that. We've been working on additional grants as well with the STIC and EDC. And then can you repeat your first question? The cost from Boston Dynamics starts at $70,000.
So that seems kind of expensive until you consider that a super tub is almost $200,000 in a pilot and the gas and everything else for it. These seem to be a more reasonable alternative for some of the things that we're going to do, especially the bridge. I've been aware through the liaison, the DOT liaison, of the bridge inspections and that sort of stuff, and that's amazing. You don't have to cart a boat up there and, you know, stand on a stepladder in a boat to try to inspect the bridge. You get a drone right there. So that in itself is pretty fascinating. Representative Vance.
Thank you. Through the chair, have you done any partnerships with the Department of Fish and Game?
Through the chair, we have not yet. This has been really just with USDA. As far as the tie-ins, that's really what we're evaluating is how can we enhance and augment that of USDA biologists on our airport environments and really expand their reach. Fairbanks, for example, just got a biologist on staff. So we found that as a perfect opportunity to add this dog in on the workflow as well. So we're like, hey, congratulations. Also, here's a robot dog to test. So, and you might be testing other dogs remotely. So really, you know, as we look at robotics and we look at AI and a lot of these technologies coming into the workforce, it's not replacing anything. It's enhancing and augmenting our ability to do more with less and not be spread so thin.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the work on innovation. I think I was listening into a call with DOT folks, and one region said, where do we get what your region has? And I think the answer was, well, there are only 12 on the planet. But I guess the question would then be, are you working toward the next areas? Do we have unmanned underwater systems? I mean, I think about keels and propellers on ferries and fish and game vessels and Department of Public Safety vessels. I think about piles and harbors and docks and bridge abutments, and we could go on and on. Is there work going on in that arena?
Through the chair, you had mentioned the ability to inspect bridges. You know, we spend a lot of time with our bridge team making sure the technology worked above water. Next year, we're focusing heavily on sonar and multi-beam and being able to look at pier scouring and underwater with pulsing LIDAR from above, pier inspection. Here in Juneau, I believe 4 or 5 months ago, we did a ROV test on being able to look down where we were driving piers. So the ability to inspect those exposed or underwater as well with a lot of these newer technologies. So yes, in our next couple of years, you know, our strategic plan is to focus heavily on the underwater side of the surface and move forward with that.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. The cost of these for, I guess, managing bird strikes, that I don't compare it to the price of a plane. I compare it to the price of a border collie. And I just wonder, is this really a demonstration usage, or is it seen as the best use of this technology?
At the moment, it is a demonstration usage, you know, and really pushing that boundary with USDA. Actually, some the reason why we originally had pivoted to the use of this platform is we had looked at using aerial application of spray drones, is using pyrrolite, which is a grape juice oil. So being able to apply that to deter wildlife, and we had got through all of the DEC paperwork and got down to basically moving forward with it, and we decided that it probably wasn't a good idea to spray in these areas because we didn't know, you know, what animals are attracted to grape juice. And you know, as we're testing all of these items across the board, how safe is having these massive ag drones out on an airport and pivoting to something that's not flying? So as far as a use case, it's definitely the first that we've found where we're using autonomy and robotics in wildlife deterrent. And so we have a lot to learn with this, and that's what we're really excited with the USDA side is the white paper and the science that will come of it, of those recommendations moving forward.
Thank you.
Nice.
Perfect.
So are we at the end? What I think I'd like to do is we
have a question.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Is it bulletproof?
Not yet. Funny that you through the chair. Not yet. It's going to be in the fence line. So
I say that because they're going to dress it like a coyote.
If it was in Louisiana, they'd be shot full of holes already.
If that is
to, a serious question. Yeah.
If that is to occur, I'm sure there's a great spot for it in the museum up at Fairbanks. So, a great lesson learned. So.
Thanks. Senator Kaufman.
Thanks. Yeah, I guess with this, can you speak a bit to the, say, the private sector tie-ins of how all of these efforts feed into optimizing, you know, the public use as that may help, yeah, you know, our economic situation? How does this act as an incubator, or how does it enhance economic activity?
Through the chair, or chair, okay. The use of this technology, the main goal for all of us, all of this, is to apply it directly to industry. So if we're developing something and it can't be utilized outside of the department, we are, in my sense, you know, there's better things that we can do with time. So in partnership with a lot of the UAS technologies, knowing that eventually these platforms will be contracted out, we'll have contractors being able to deploy these for monitoring well sites, contamination areas, spawning streams, bridges. So it's one of those items where the initial work that we're putting into it and those waivers, we're making sure to write them and define the safety parameters with FAA so they can be applied to industry and hand those over. I am glad you brought that up. One of the more amazing items is, once again, our partnership with Akwasi up in Fairbanks is we have the ability to take public COAs under the 44803 Charlie exemption with FAA and transfer them into civil operations. That is an incredible opportunity where we can transfer these to third-party groups. Say somebody out in Iliamna wants to test a small aircraft jumping from, you know, our docking system. Now that's possible. So it's really opening up the economic opportunities for these communities to start facilitating this, which is why you'll see our Aero program, where we're going out to these communities, we're showing them how this technology works, and we're leaving that technology there. You know, it's important for them to figure out how it works in their own ways and showcase what works best for us as far as those remote operations. And so, yes, as far as our deployment strategy, a lot of these is partnering with industry, finding those folks that are just quite there, you know, locally here with software, hardware, and partnering with them to develop those platforms moving forward so they can be deployed across the state.
Thank you.
Thanks. Anyone else have any questions? So, gentlemen, thanks so much for your presentation. What I think I'd like to do is we'll adjourn the meeting, and then there's a few members of the media here. Maybe you can walk it up and down the hall and maybe even the stairways. Perfect. Watching it go up the stairs is pretty cool if you haven't seen it. So I'm sure that they would like to get some pictures. And I'd also like to thank KTOO. Apparently their camera work today with the drone and everything going on has been superlative. So that's it's nice knowing that we can do that. So With that, that concludes our business today for the House. Our next meeting will be on Thursday, March 21st, when we'll hear SB 141 and HB 332. Chair Coffin.
Thank you. For Senate Transportation, our next meeting will be on Thursday, March 21, in our normal time and place. With that, seeing no other business before us, we'll adjourn this joint meeting on behalf of both Senate House Transportation. Let the record reflect that the time is 2:23 p.m.